Okay, let us go ahead and get started. This afternoon, we move into our larger comparative and theoretical focus. For the first two talks, we'll be focusing on India, and in a slight change from our schedule, we'll do the first two talks, then a break, and then we will turn to our last three talks, one on Greece and Rome, and then a final larger theoretical discussion. And therefore, it is my deep honor to begin by introducing Charles Malamud, who of course needs no introduction. He will be speaking today on ritual and language in Vedic India. So please join me in giving our very warmest welcome to Professor Charles Malamud.
Thank you. Well, I'm very honored by Professor Alan Chang's invitation, very grateful also, and of course, embarrassed. I endeavor to present some aspects of Vedic ritual to an audience mainly composed of sinologists at the risk of being somewhat dogmatic and obscure, and at the same time to repeat what is common knowledge to Indologists. Well, let me try. I can say that now that I will be very brief, which maybe is a relief for you. All we know of Vedic India, a period comprised roughly between 1200 and 500 BC, comes from texts called Veda. No other kind of text, no data coming from outside, almost no archaeological remains whatever. Another term for Veda in Indian, or more specifically Vedic tradition, is Shruti, literally what is heard or the process of hearing. This name refers to the fact that one has to learn the Veda by listening to a master while he recites the text and by repeating what he says. Even today, it is forbidden in principle to learn the Veda by grasping it from a written or printed copy. Actually, the Vedic texts were composed long before writing came in usage in India. There is no mention of writing whatever in Vedic texts. The Veda or Shruti is a set of texts and layers of texts. It is a corpus. Let me try to briefly characterize the elements of this corpus. There are four Vedas. The most ancient layer of each of these Vedas consists in collections, Sanhita, collections of poems for the Rig Veda, the Veda of verses, and the Atharva Veda, collections of sacrificial formulas for the Yajur Veda. The Sama Veda is a selection of the poems of the Rig Veda arranged to be sung. A second layer for each of these Vedas consists in treatises in prose, the Brahmanas, the content of which is a full and profuse doctrine of ritual and more specifically of sacrifice. Can we compare this corpus to a body? I don't think we find this comparison expressed in so many words, but it is implied by the expression Vedanga, which means limbs of the Veda. These limbs are not of the same stuff as the Veda proper. They are treatises added to the Veda. They are meant to help the student understand its meaning and its structure, whereas the Veda proper is supposed to be eternal, without beginning, and to have been revealed to seers who saw the content and transposed their vision into sequences of words that amount to the Vedic corpus as we have it. Well, the limbs of the Veda, the Vedanga have been composed by human authors. There are six Vedanga. The list as such is mentioned and dealt with in the epics and in the laws of Manu, that is, around the beginning of Common Era. But the treatises themselves, at least some of them, notably the treatises on ritual, are much older. Here is the list of these limbs added to the to the corpus of the Veda. Grammar, phonetics, meter, etymology, astronomy, and ritual, kalpa. With the exception of astronomy, jyotisha, the subject matter of these Vedanga bear on language. This is obvious for grammar, phonetics, meter, etymology. But it is true also for kalpa, ritual. How so? These treatises on kalpa, on ritual, select in the Vedic texts the sentences which consist in instructions on the actual performance of the ritual, on the procedure of the ritual, putting to one side all the rest. Moreover, these instructions on the way a given ritual should be performed are very often in the original Brahmana, scattered, separated by other developments, especially on the reasons and functions of the given ritual. These reformulations of the Vedic sentences and developments of the Vedic texts, namely the Brahmanas and the ritual Samhitas of the Black Yajurveda, this restructuration of the Vedic material led to the creation of a specific style, the Sutra style, characterized by very crisp and dense sentences with all the grammatical and stylistic devices that enable an author to be so dense and brief. Nowadays, and it is so since the beginnings of Western Indology, when a scholar sets to study a particular Vedic ritual, he starts with an analysis of what is said in the relevant Kalpa Sutra before turning to the text of the Veda proper, where this ritual is enjoyed, explained, and praised. One traditionally distinguishes two types of rites, Shrauta and Grihya, solemn and domestic. The solemn rites are enjoyed by the Veda proper. They belong to the sphere of the Shruti, whereas the domestic rites are enjoined by special Kalpa Sutra called Grihya Sutra, Sutra of the House. Let us stick for the time being to solemn ritual. It deals with sacrifice, yajna. Not all the rituals are sacrifices, but the sacrificial model is so strong that very often domestic rituals, especially those that are called sanskara, making perfect or complete, actually rite de passage, are interpreted in terms of sacrifice. The word for sacrifice is yajna, from the verbal root yaj. From this root is derived the noun of the sacrificer, yajamana, and the verb yajate, which means he offers a sacrifice. Both yajamana and yajate are forms of what is called middle, in Sanskrit, atmanepada, word for oneself. The middle voice in the verbs in Sanskrit, is used when the result of the action affects directly the doer, the sacrificer, yajamana. The sacrificer, the yajamana, performs the sacrifice in such a way that his own self is modified, affected by his action. Normally, the sacrificer, yajamana, is one person. Collective sacrifices, and even sacrifices for the benefit of a group, are exceptions. We can mention the variety of sacrifice called satra. But it is really the exception. However, the sacrificer, to offer his sacrifice, must have his wife with him on the sacrificial ground. Now, this action of the sacrificer cannot be achieved without the presence and the action of another dramatis persona, the ritvij, the priest in a way, let us say the expert in ritual. His role is described by another form of the verbal root yaj, the causative, yajayati, which means he makes the sacrificer sacrifice. Actually, not just one officiating priest is required. Normally, a team of 16 should be there, four groups of four. Each of these groups is specialized in one type of action, reciting aloud the appropriate stanza from the Rig Veda to accompany every step of the offering, whispering formulas of the Yajurveda and doing the required gestures and movements, chanting the melodies of the Samaveda, watching and correcting errors in the very intricate process of this ceremony. When the Yajna involves the immolation of an animal victim, an executioner, shamiter, is also required. Now, another form of the verbal root yaj must be examined. It is yajeta, the optative middle, meaning he should offer. It addresses, of course, the yajamana. This is an injunction, yajeta, the typical form of injunction. In a sense, the whole system rests on this expression. Let me elaborate briefly. In the first centuries of Common Era, a school of thought, a philosophy, if you like, appears which presents itself as an elucidation of that part of the Veda which contains instructions on ritual. This school is called Mimamsa, which means disquisition, exegesis, literally the will to think. It presents itself as an exegesis of the Vedic text, or rather of those parts of the Vedic text that are instructions on sacrifice. The Veda is authoritative because it has no author, human or divine. It is eternal. It was never created. There is no personal bias in what it says. But this holds true only for the injunctions, vidhi. The injunctions, vidhi, it contains. The rest of the text, for example, descriptions or just mentions of the bliss which results for the sacrificer, yajamana, from the execution of sacrifices, or the narratives on the origin of such and such ritual. All these texts, which are not prescriptions, are not authoritative. Then, what is their function, their status, according to the Mimamsa? Well, they are psychological incentives. They are or can be useful. They are arthavada, which means discourses with an aim. There is no obligation to hold that what they say is true. So you can be most scrupulous in the execution of rites without believing in God. This notion of arthavada, discourse with an aim, incentive, is not to be found exclusively in the texts of the Mimamsa. The law texts, for instance, use this distinction between vidhi and arthavada. Still, the example of vidhi, rule, injunction, which is produced again and again in the text of the school is Swarga Kamo Jyotishtomena Yajeta, which means desiring heaven, Swarga Kamo. Desiring heaven, one should offer the sacrifice called Jyotishtoma. Yajeta here is the optative of the verb yajate, he offers a sacrifice. The optative means he should offer. For his own sake, it is the middle voice. Does it mean that the result of this sacrifice will be heaven? This heaven he must desire. Does it mean that such a thing as heaven exists? Is there implicitly a promise? No, this means only that to qualify for such type of sacrifice, you have to desire heaven. But skepticism yields in front of Vedic injunctions. The suffix of optative in the verb yajeta creates something new, unprecedented, apurva, in the mind of the listener, which prompts him to obey the injunction, and similarly, but this is more difficult to understand, the performance of the ritual as it is prescribed by the injunction creates something new, a new reality, apurva, a mechanism of sorts which may bring about the results hoped for. So much for this school of Vedic exegesis. I would like to turn now, briefly, to three topics. First, the relationship between sacrifice as it is described or enjoyed in the Veda and the Shauta Sutra with other types of ritual. Not all rituals are sacrifices, but in the texts that prescribe or describe these rituals, the sacrificial scheme is referred to and can be agreed to interpret them as a sacrifice, especially the sanskara rite de passage. For instance, funerals. The corpse is explicitly prepared to be transformed into a sacrificial victim, an oblation for the god of fire, Agni, who actually is ready to devour it, the sacrificer, Yajamana, being in this circumstance the main mourner. Or again, in the ritual of marriage, the bride is the victim offered by a sacrificer who is his father to a deity who is the groom. There are many examples of this kind of analogy. The relationship between the world of sacrifice and the world outside, the world of everyday causality. Actually, the sacrificial ground is sharply separated from the space around it. To take part to a solemn sacrifice, one has first to transform oneself, to acquire a new self. Here is how the Shatapatha Brahmana describes this process. Therefore, in saying, "I know, I now enter from untruth into truth," he passes from the man to the gods. After the completion of the sacrifice, he says, "Now I am he who I really am." For in entering upon the vow, he becomes, as it were, non-human. And as it would not be becoming for him to say, "I enter from truth into untruth," and as in fact he now again becomes man after a period when he was a god, let him therefore divest himself of the vow with the text, "Now I am he who I really am." I'm sorry for the clumsy translation. It is not mine. It is Egling's, who was a German. But nevertheless, he was published at the Sacred Books of the East in the Oxford Press. That's Egling translation, Sacred Books of the East, volume 12. Sacrificial truth, as one can see, is different from Egling translation. Sacrificial truth, as one can see, is different from worldly reality. Idam aham anritat satyam upaimi iti, tan manushyebhyo devan upaiti nahitad, and so on. I skip the quotation in Sanskrit. This describes the diksha, the ritual of consecration the sacrificer undergoes on the sacrificial ground in order to acquire the new body which allows him to proceed with the sacrifice proper. He has to become a dikshita, one who underwent diksha. Now, there is at least one feature in the sacrificial world which connects it to the world of everyday life. It is the dakshina, the gifts the officiating priests receive from the sacrificer. It is a moment, a very important one, of the ceremony itself. It is a ritual in the ritual. Actually, there are sharp controversies as to the interpretation of dakshina. Is it a kind of salary, a fee meant to retribute these Brahmins for their work? According to some, the sacrificer gives to the officiating priests are actually offerings on par with oblations offered to the gods. But for the adepts of the Purva Mimamsa, it is not so. The officiating priests are hired for their skill, and because without them, the ritual could not take place. While the sacrificers have to undergo the ritual of consecration, diksha, the priests don't. They are just experts. The Mimamsaka coined this formula, which is very clever in Sanskrit. Adikshita, dakshina, dakshina avikrita, dikshitam yajayanti, which means non-consecrated, adikshita, hired by dakshina, dakshina vikrita. They make the consecrated one sacrifice, dikshitam yajayanti. Now, I would like to give two examples of Artavada. Maybe you remember, there were one distinguishes in the treatises on sacrifice two groups, the vidi, the rules, which are to be followed, and the Atharvada, the discourse with the name, which are incentives to action, but which are not authoritative. But still, many things are said in these Atharvada, which means, I repeat, discourse with an aim, with an objective. To begin with, one of the numerous narratives on the origin of sacrifice runs so. Once upon a time, the gods and the asuras, demons, both of them sprung from Prajapati, the cosmogonic god. They strove together, and the asuras, even through arrogance, thinking, unto whom, forsooth, should we make offering, went on offering into their own mouth. They came to naught. But the gods went on making offerings unto one another. Prajapati gave himself up to them, thus the sacrifice became theirs, and indeed the sacrifice is the food of the gods. So this is the first step of sacrifice, reciprocity, instead of swallowing by oneself, offering to oneself. To conclude, I would like to produce this dense and far-reaching definition which envelopes, which involves a large part of what I have tried to say up to now. It is a definition of man, of animals fit to be sacrificial victims. Only man is a sacrificer. I have limited my remarks to ritual as it is dealt with by ritualists whose main interest is the mechanism of sacrifice and the language used to describe it. Of course, sacrifice and ritual at large must also be studied for their function in social and even cosmic life. This would lead us to the very core of the notion of dharma. Sacrifice is a duty for those who are entitled to perform it. It is at the core of the vast system of duties on which the world rests. Thank you.